Αστηρή podcast.
Vítajte pri podcaste Bratislavského nezávislého kultúrneho centra A4. V pravidelnom mesačnom podcaste sa budeme zaoberať tým, čo máme najradšej, súčasnou kultúrou.
Pripravujeme pre vás rozhovory a diskusie s umelkyňami a umelcami, zaujímavými hostiami a hostkami a kultúrnymi aktérmi. S experimentálnou hudobničkou Eviction sme sa bavili o jej začiatkoch, momente improvizácie a tvorby a o jej ceste k vlastnému výrazu. Eviction vystúpila na festivale Next, kde priniesla smršť zloženú z hluku a odvážneho performatívneho prejavu. Rozhovor sme viedli v anglickom jazyku.
One of the topics we have is musical education and also kind of empowerment of people who don't have natural access to education, particularly about electronic music or experimental electronic music. Mm-hmm. What was your journey to music, and did you have any significant pivotal moments that gave you the idea that you want to dedicate yourself to music?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've always really enjoyed music and like was a big dancer as a kid, not in any official way, but just as in like a involuntary movement to sound kind of way. And then I definitely became very interested in more like experimental, like noise rock, no wave, some like weird indie folk stuff. I just really loved music, like very in the very broad sense, and like had a special appetite for like the kind of weirder, more underground stuff. But generally I was much more into visual arts, and I went to school for visual arts. But luckily for me, I took a sound class on a whim, and then because of that sound class, I had access to this workshop. And in that workshop, it was led by this woman, Jessica Ryland, who had this company called Flower Electronics. And so we were soldering. So I soldered for the first time during this workshop, and she liked the way my solder joints looked. And so she hired me on the spot. And I ended up working for her for like 5 years, just what we call stuffing boards, like putting components in and then soldering them. But then like graduating to like, learn some theory, learn like PCB layout design and other aspects to like the business side, like inventory, bill of materials, like, you know, this type of thing. And then, yeah, and she was actually probably the first like kind of strong female figure in my life who like taught me how to like drill holes in aluminum. And like, you know, gave me this sense of competence, like, and through the portal of like a woman was like pretty amazing. My natural attitude towards stuff is like, oh yeah, why would you buy it when you can build it? And so like even to this day, like when I do performances, I don't use gear unless either I built it or it was a gift, to keep things like really cheap in this way. But yeah, and then the other kind of like side effect of that, like building stuff yourself, is like you also feel okay with breaking it. And so, you know, my performances, I often am pretty cavalier with my gear, or like even violent. So, but that's because like, you know, I know that I can rebuild it if it breaks. Generally, it's more difficult now that I have nicer stuff. But anyway, yeah, so unfortunately, I would say like in my case, like I had to sort of pay to play, in the sense like I had to borrow money to like pay for school. Not that I would take it back, but I had $80,000 in debt when I graduated. That's part of the reason why I like to keep things cheap. The other thing is, like, you know, I had so much drive in a sense, and like a thirst for like learning stuff. I mean, it didn't just stop at Flower Electronics. Like, I also weaseled my way into like different classes. Like, I was like auditing classes. I was sneaking into classes after I'd graduated just to like take And I also ended up like taking this class at MIT for free, which was another like really mind-blowing class called How to Make Almost Anything. And I think they actually have this class for free under a different name called Fab Academy. And so it gives you like the sort of tools to like actually like make your own Arduino stuff, like not just do Arduino, but like make your own microcontrollers. And and so that really like even exploded further, like the just like the initial seed that Jessica had planted. It's really great to, in some way, like, pass it forward. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, if you have drive, you can, like, really figure stuff out yourself. There's so many people who are, like, very self-taught. But I think it is important to have these basic tools on how to navigate not just the world, but, like, the objects that you use every day and have, like, a very basic understanding of it. And it allows for a lot of freedom. And I would say, like, you know, just because it's new doesn't make it better. And so like a lot of my interest is in sort of like much more accessible like electroacoustic things like records. I think like records as a spinning object are going to outlast like hard drives, and that's something you can learn how to make. You can learn how to mold and cast records, or to like even like make your own lathes.
Maybe I will ask follow-up questions to this, because maybe this is also the way that you are maybe passing on or giving back what you got from somebody who somehow empowered you. But also in Europe you've been the visitor or you participated in several projects, like in Copenhagen.
Totally.
Or Rotterdam.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I wanted to ask about the difference between the approach in academic fields or this academic approach in US and Europe, if you feel some difference, and what are your thoughts on this?
I think there's a huge difference. I mean, there's just some, like, Europe is so much more open and receptive and expectant of artists, right? Like, it's a given. It's like, of course we want to fund the humanities, whereas in the US, there's not that much money in like, the arts at all. And, like, whatever, I'll, like, present, do artist talks at, like, Yale or, like, Columbia and do studio visits and stuff. And it's like, okay, it's, like, a nice fee, but it's, like, very rare that you get the chance to do that. It's like once every 5 years or something per institution. But in Europe, people are so much more open to what your practice is. They're so much more engaged, at least institutionally. So that's like the biggest difference to me is that like there's just, yeah, it's much easier to make it as an artist in Europe, as far as I can tell. I mean, this year I've come to Europe like 6 times. This is my 6th time I'm here, because all the good fees are here, like all the festivals are here, you know what I mean? But yeah, like academically, yeah, I don't know. I guess they're both pretty rigorous, but they're both talking to like different traditions. I think like the US is maybe slightly edges Europe out on like the more like racially attuned, racially aware tip. But I mean, that's maybe I'm like changing my thought on that, especially recently with like the, you know, the Palestine, like Israeli conflict, because a lot of universities are actually like censoring. But ordinarily, it seems like they're a lot more progressive in like the stuff that they talk about. Europe is still actually a lot more backwards in a lot of like the race stuff that I've noticed, just being perfectly frank. But aside from that, I mean, I think, you know, higher learning institutions are like really, I mean, great in the fact that they are trying to support artists, even if there's a difference in funding, still like the spirit is there. But yeah, I mean, I like traveling to Europe, especially like the southern parts, just because.
Yeah, of course. You came from kind of school environment as a visual arts student.
Mm-hmm.
How did you? When was it for you when you actually realized that you want to do something like this?
Mm-hmm.
And how do you even like place yourself in this field between what I said was like some kind of rigorous academic mm-hmm. background, mm-hmm. and maybe on the other side of the spectrum would be some kind of like a punkish, just do-it-yourself establishment.
Yeah, I think there's two major kind of events or threads, I guess, in the journey. One is like totally stupid, and the other is like kind of like overly pretentious, like in the opposite direction. So like I didn't really start making music, even though I was making synthesizers, until I met this like kind of man child in San Francisco, and I was like totally inspired, and he was like my muse because he was like totally present and all this stuff. I smoked weed with him for the first time, all this other shit. And it was like very inspiring to like, okay, I want to make, and I want to like have something to present to this person. He since has like OD'd and is dead, but like, I really, really feel like I owe a lot to his kind of like spirit of like being present and like, and open and like, you know, kind of just funny and experimental. So yeah, that's like when I first started performing, I was like, I should start a band. And so I started a band with a drummer and myself, like kind of on the Mind Flayer, like lightning bolt tip, where I was like running her drums through my synths and doing these performances. And slowly I was like developing a language for performance. And so like, it was like getting more and more confrontational and more like in response and site to the specific space and being like very, tailored to like the moment and the audience and like also pushing boundaries in this way, which came totally intuitively. But then on the other hand, the more highfalutin I think approach was that I was framing stuff through like the visual art history of like performance and just like even painting. And so I was thinking a lot about like abstract expressionist painters and like the way that they've been like canonized and like talked about by, say, like this critic Clement Greenberg, who talks about creating a critical gap between the viewer and the abstract art. And the point of like abstract expressionism is to like make art only for art's sake, that is like escapes any political agenda, that has no embedded ideology. It's pure aesthetic, sublime experience, right? And of course, that's totally bullshit, right? Like, there's only value that's projected onto it based on, like, the context and the framing. So yeah, to me it's like, okay, so I think that painting is like kind of dead in this sort of way. I mean, it's not dead because it sells. Like, if anything, painting is the only thing that sells anymore in the art world, right? That's like, yeah, sure, far away. Anyway, but like, I was thinking that still, like, those initial tenets, like that instinct, that impulse that Clement Greenberg felt, can be applied in the realm of sound. Still, because sound has this ability to evade a lot of language. And I just think that abstraction and sound is really powerful, because then really people can be put in this defamiliarized situation where they're very uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And then in that moment of being challenged, they have to renegotiate like their values, like what they think is a good aesthetic experience, what they feel like is their limits of enjoyment, and like why they're evaluating this experience, like what their criteria is. And so anyway, so it's like a mixture between like, yeah, like the void, the void of meaning, and like the landfill of meaning, like the garbage dump of meaning, which is like all the other shit that we're surrounded with. So just like going between those two, like creating an interface, I think is what my goal is in performance.
And in what way do you consider your sound political? I would ask. Yeah. What is the way you think about this? About your sound you produce as political sound?
For sure. So in one way, like if somebody is not to even look at the performance, just to hear it, it's purely abstract. There's no genre that's being referenced, unless, I mean, I'm playing with records now more. Before, it used to be just pure synths and electronics. And so there is a little bit of text to hold on to, you know, in the performance, but otherwise it's completely abstract. So that's the void, right? And then the landfill is like, I really implicate my own body, the body of other people in the audience, and like the space that we're in. And so, like I was saying, like trying to pose these two things together and create these kinds of sounds that are diegetically connected to the body. Like you can see that this whatever short Asian female body is like producing these like very like loud, abrasive, whatever sounds. And it's like, you know, I can't like make a one-to-one like meaning evaluation, like, oh yeah, this is what it means. Like, oh, when I use my nails on a record, like this is what it means. It's more so like an affect, like as in a feeling that emerges from it, where maybe it is empowerment, maybe it's disgust, but it's this play with like the abject and like the material and like things that are like pre-linguistic, I think, and like to a lot of people, it seems like it's a really compelling approach. To reference like the body in this way, to make these sounds that don't have any genre referent.
You described your sound as a chaotic sound. Mm-hmm. I read about this.
Yeah, so that's really kind of loaded because it's chaotic in a bunch of different layers. Like, one, I'm an improvisational performer, and like you kind of have to like throw yourself into chaos in order to like, I think, improvise, right? You have to be open to the unpredictable. And then on another very basic fundamental way, the circuits that I'm using, a lot of them are founded on chaotic principles, like chaotic as in like chaos theory, like systems that are very sensitive to initial parameters. And it's a fascinating field of study. It was first observed in like animal ecology and fish populations, like looking at harvest rates over different generations. Like, okay, you fish one fish versus two fish in the same population, and then like eight generations later, either the population collapses or it's like booming, you know what I mean? So it's really fascinating, and you know, it applies to economy and like math and stuff like this, but yeah, it also applies in sound. It's like if you look at on an oscilloscope, like things that are like chaotic synths, you have one parameter, one patch, and then it can go off and just have very complex aperiodic sounds. And so a lot of the synths that I'm using are founded on those mathematic principles, especially from Flower Electronics, but even I haven't been using it lately, but like the Benjelin, which was created by Rob Hordijk, this Dutch synth designer, rest in peace, I think he died pretty recently. But even other stuff like Soma synths also have some like chaotic qualities too. But these are the things that I really am attracted to, because they buck like the illusion of mastery, or like the idea of mastery, of reproducibility, whatever. So anything that happens is like very specific to the exact moment. So that's in part why I'm attracted to chaos.
I still imagine that when you perform with the sound, you have like a, I imagine as a some handful of chaoses in your hands, and evolving and ever going into some entropy or something. Mm-hmm. And do you like to be more like in control of this, or more like letting it go and being just surprised with the chaos? What is your feeling when you perform?
It's back and forth, you know. I think it's like a in a way, it's like stirring the pot when cooking. It's like sometimes you like let it cook, and then sometimes you have to like stir it to get things flowing, so to speak. But it's all like intuitively based, and like, okay, like this is a really dynamic sound. Like, oh, I'm really enjoying this in the moment, like this specific patch or whatever, before I change the parameter or something like this. But I have to say, my performances tend to be pretty like fast paced. I mean, I think I probably could, if I tried, do a more like ambient practice where, yeah, I just like kind of set it and like let it cook on its own. But generally it's a lot more active these days. But if mm-hmm. I do like a light on like a thing that sounds really good, I'll just like leave it going for a little while.
And you also made a record with Kronos Quartet, or collaborated with them?
Yeah.
How did it work with your approach and their maybe a little bit different approach?
Oh, wow. Yeah, that was so, I mean, surprising. You know, unfortunately, Instagram is like a very necessary evil in my, I mean, like, I got my a teaching gig through Instagram, and like Kronos Quartet, I think, found me through Instagram. We happened to be in the same city, so David Harrington is like the founder. And so we just had coffee, and we're just like talking about different ideas. And he's like, well, what do you think we could do? And I was like, well, I've been making these turntables where I use violin bows and I put needles at the end. And so that acts like the tone arm on like, you know, a spinning record. And it would be really wonderful to like take records of you playing, and then not only have you like play your own instrument, but then also play the record of you playing using the bow. And so he's like, oh yeah, that's like a really great idea. And so then we worked on developing a live performance together where we did exactly that. And I made these like turntables that are controlled by foot pedals, so you can change like not just the speed, but also the direction, so it can go backwards. And so like when we performed it, some of them were playing their own instruments while the others were playing like the record. And they were playing the sounds backwards and stuff too. So it was like this real confusion of like live versus playback. And then, so that was like the first collaboration. The second collaboration is we're doing a Sun Ra record where we're able to either sample or re-perform different Sun Ra pieces. We're given permission from Red Hot, which is like the Sun Ra record label. So I made a record that was My Brother the Wind, and I cut all of the grooves so that they become locked grooves. So they're like orbits, you know, to just stay within the planetary theme. And then played it with like the fingernails and like reproduce the records. I bootlegged the same, right? I don't know if you know about this, but like you can also make a silicone mold and then like mm-hmm. cast that and just double it in this way. And so like the goal is, well, it's going to come out on a record and as a compilation with like luminaries like Terry Riley, like Laurie Anderson, Marshall Allen. So that's really Trey Spruance.
It's a nice company.
I know. I know. It's very flattering to be in this company, but like, so those guys, but also we're going to do a live performance, like much with the same, in the same kind of format as like the first thing. Mm-hmm. And then also we're like talking about doing another, a couple of other pieces in the future for 2025 and stuff. But anyway, yeah, so it's like all it takes is like someone who's established, who is like still very much in touch with like the underground or, you know, like the new. And then I just feel very honored, you know, and privileged to be working with these people who are like just so open and so established at the same time.
Do you also have a like tendency to maybe pull some new talents or somebody you've seen playing for the first time to get to your, I don't know, some project or?
I wish. No. I'm actually really, I think it's probably not good, but like I've really started to only look backwards in time in terms of what I consume. I mean, it's really lovely traveling because I get to meet contemporaries, you know, but I haven't really done that as much as like, I think I will have to start to do it like this, but I've been kind of like focused on like my own projects. And then if somebody asks me to collaborate, like that's how it's usually worked, and not the other way around where I see someone I'm inspired by and like I want to collaborate.
Yeah.
I should do that more though.
It's okay. Yeah. Also I wanted to ask about tonight.
Mm.
What kind of performance should we expect?
Yeah.
And I also heard about the names of your instruments, which all sound very like bodily or crude in a way.
Yeah.
And what instruments did you bring?
Okay, so the first thing is the needle nails, which is just like acrylic nails with record styluses in them, and so I can play records this way. So that's the first instrument. The records are another instrument that I'm playing that are like made of resin usually, because when the needle nails came out, there was like so much like negative commentary about how I'm destroying records, which I found in the trash anyway. But I'm playing some found records and some made records that that are transparent. And then I'm using turntables that I built too that have like embedded lights in them, so they project the color of the record through, and so it's a really really convenient way to like see actually how fast the record is spinning. So I have some also instruments from Flower Electronics that I'm going to be using, like the Jealous Heart. I have some Make Noise stuff, so I'm using, these were gifts, which is really, thank you Make Noise. The Spectrophon, which is their newest module, is amazing, gorgeous, gorgeous synthesizer. I'm using what is that thing called? A Morphogene also, which is like a sampler thing. Microsound synth. And then what else am I bringing? The Lyra 8 that I built from a PCB. The landscape stereo field. And then I have amplified music box, amplified snare wires, a resin comb that I embedded piezos in. What else am I playing? Oh, this thing called the bass collar, which is like a dog collar with a guitar pickup in the throat. Mm-hmm. And then from the throat comes two bass strings, and then I play that by, you know, bowing, plucking, flicking, whatever, and you change the pitch by, like, either taking your hand and pulling the strings away from you, and so changing the tension that way. I mean, it's dramatic.
Yeah.
But, like, and then the other way to do it is, like, I put my foot through the strings and then tension it with my foot, and that way you actually get, like, bassier, like, access to a bassier range of notes and pitches. I think is that it? Oh, and then I'll also have a bullwhip, which is a nice acoustic instrument. Always think it's amplified, but it's no, it's purely acoustic, and it creates a sonic boom because the speed of the end of the whip actually breaks the sound barrier. And so yeah, I mean, depending on the space, sometimes it doesn't work really well. Some venues are very well acoustically treated, and so like it just absorbs all the sound. But other places, like say if you play in like a concrete what's that word, like vault or something, or like a cistern, that crack travels a lot and sounds, it's very dramatic. So yeah, I just spoiled the whole set, so anyone who's listening to this doesn't actually have to see the set, because this is
it's for the future. So
oh good, perfect, good, yeah, this will it'll explain everything they saw. Yeah,
I also wanted to ask about the records, because I'm always interested in the idea of if the musician has more like the record is just some reminiscence of something, or do you actually create the stuff for the record, or is the live show more important for you than the record?
Oh, you mean like for my personal music? Like I mean, records that I release, you mean?
Yeah, records that you release,
oh,
yes.
Yeah, you know, it's complicated because I've released, in a sense, multiple records. Like, there's, like, the official record where it's, like, a label asked me to release something, and then I did, like, the thing, and then got it pressed, all that shit. But then the other thing that I was doing was I was taking records and then cutting them up, combining them, then doing, like, you know, this molding and casting method, and so making these resin duplicates that are playable.
It's like dub plate or something like that?
Not really. It's because it's totally...
It's just a negative, and you make a negative and then the positive of the record?
Yeah, exactly.
From resin.
From resin, exactly. Mm-hmm. And it's surprisingly, like, the fidelity is good. It's crazy. It's really... Like, when I first tried it, I was, like, astonished that it worked at all. But, yeah, and then I was selling those, and that was actually paying my rent during the pandemic, was like selling these records, and I may have made more money off of selling those records than like my official whatever record. But like, yeah, I mean, I will say that like the live show I think has become more central to my practice as an artist, but I still enjoy composition and producing a record, even if it's not like, okay, this is like a record, but I've been producing compositions for like say this auditorium in San Francisco called Audium that was like founded in like the 1960s, that has like 170 speakers, and so making a specific composition for that. So I would say, yeah, composition and arrangement is definitely a part of my practice and is important, but oftentimes I'm using the live material as the source for a lot of those compositions.
The musician who was playing yesterday from Oslo, I think. She said you played at some festival in Norway.
Yeah.
And she said that it was the best performance of the festival.
So wow. Speaking of cracking whips in like really reverberant places, there's this giant crypt called the Vigeland's crypt, totally close by train. But the decay time is a minute. So you clap and then and the sound dances around. It was incredible. And I waited like 2 hours in there for everybody to leave so I could record the whip cracking. I actually used some Loam mics to record it.
Yeah.
So after this, I'm going to go to Loam actually to go visit
Jonas.
Yes. Yeah, Jonas. Yeah, yes. Yeah. So anyhow. Oh, yeah. Great. Oslo is awesome. Cool.
Great.
Tento podcast vznikol ako súčasť projektu New Perspectives for Action, v rámci medzinárodnej spolupráce Reimagine Europe, spolufinancovaného Európskou úniou a z verejných zdrojov podporeného Fondom na podporu umenia a nadáciu mesta Bratislavy. Ďakujeme.